From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, Democracy Now! Joins Pacifica station WBAI in a historic move to Wall Street. We'll take you on a tour. And then a conversation with current Georgia Congressmember John Lewis as he recalls his extraordinary journey from the cotton farm in Alabama where he grew up to the center of the civil rights struggle to Congress. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. CNN and Time magazine are reporting that the U.S. military used lethal nerve gas during the Vietnam War, targeting American defectors in a village base camp in Laos. Admiral Thomas Moore, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, confirmed that sarin nerve gas was used in 1970 in a secret raid into Laos called Operation Tailwind. Captain Eugene McCarley, commander of the mission, told the program newsstand CNN and Time that upwards of 100 people perished in the raid, including women and children. Platoon leader Lieutenant Robert Van Buskirk estimated up to 20 American military defectors were killed. The Pentagon said yesterday its own research did not indicate that nerve gas was used during the Vietnam War. The report, which also appears in the issue of Time that's out today, said the U.S. has not before admitted to using sarin in combat. Sarin is the gas used in a 1995 Tokyo subway attack that killed 12 people and made thousands ill. Admiral Moore told the program the White House National Security Team of President Richard Nixon approved use of the nerve gas and the CIA had partial responsibility for the operation. He said he was speaking out now because of his respect for history. The report quoted military officials and soldiers who took part in the raids as saying that the sarin gas was dropped on more than 20 missions in Laos and North Vietnam. The year of the Tailwind mission, Nixon had pledged a no-first-use policy on nerve gas as part of his commitment to the Geneva Protocol limiting chemical weapons use, but the Senate had not yet ratified the Chemical Weapons Treaty. The former platoon leader Van Buskirk told CNN and Time he had orders to kill everyone, including U.S. defectors. One of the soldiers on the mission, Jim Cathy, said that he spent 5 hours closely observing the village base camp and saw 10 to 15 Caucasians. Cathy said, "I believe that there were American defectors in that group of people in that village because there was no sign of any restraint," he said. "In retrospect, I believe that mission was to wipe out those long shadows," as defectors were known since they were taller than Laotians and Vietnamese. In an off-camera interview, Moore acknowledged that Tailwind's target was the defectors in the village. European Union foreign ministers agreed today to apply a ban on new investments in Serbia in response to action by Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic in Kosovo province. This news from New Delhi. Prime Minister AB Vajpayee today attacked a UN Security Council condemnation of India's nuclear tests as completely unhelpful and said he stood ready for earliest talks with Pakistan. Vajpayee told the upper house of parliament that the council's call to India to halt nuclear testing was redundant because New Delhi had already instituted a voluntary moratorium. Vajpayee said he had written his Pakistani counterpart to say that a secure and prosperous Pakistan is in India's interest and that India was ready to talk with Islamabad. President Clinton today opens a three-day UN International Drug Conference. More than 30 world leaders are attending the General Assembly session, which will meet morning, noon, and night to accommodate the 150 countries taking part. The outcome will be an ambitious political declaration aimed at substantially reducing the supply of illicit drugs and the demand for them by the year 2008. There will also be an alternative conference on the war on drugs taking place simultaneously. More than 100 non-governmental organizations will participate, including many coca growers and indigenous organizations from throughout Central and Latin America. Meanwhile, more than 100 politicians, activists, and law enforcement officials signed an open letter published today in a 2-full-page ad in the New York Times to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan saying, "We believe the global war on drugs is now causing more harm than drug abuse. abuse itself. This news from Geneva. In an important test of European sentiment on genetic engineering, Swiss voters yesterday decisively rejected a ballot measure to place broad restrictions on biomedical and other research involving genetically modified animals. Drug companies were said by opponents to have spent $35 million to persuade voters to reject the measure, although the industry would not release the total. The coalition supporting the measure raised $1.3 million for its campaign. Talks on a strike at a General Motors Corporation metal stamping plant recessed yesterday without agreement, setting the stage for the automaker to begin scaling back car and truck production early this week. Some 3,400 hourly workers from United Auto Workers Union Local 659 went on strike on Friday at the Flint Metal Center in Flint, Michigan. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with some of these news headlines, on that General Motors strike, analysts say GM could lose up to $300 million a week in profits if all its 15 affected assembly plants are idled. And a House panel approved a bill limiting U.S. aid for bilingual education. The 22-17 vote by the Education and Workforce Committee followed a state referendum June 2nd, in which Californians agreed to dismantle their bilingual education programs. The House bill, opposed by the Clinton administration, would limit to 3 years students' participation in programs that teach in languages other than English. And as I said, you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And today, for the first time, we are broadcasting from our new home on Wall Street. That's right, Pacifica Station WBAI has just completed its move to Wall Street. And so the voice of the people now broadcasts from the belly of the beast. We hope today to be bringing you on a tour of Wall Street if our tour guide shows up. But right now, we're going to turn first to another story, actually, another life. 30 years ago this month, Robert Kennedy was assassinated just moments after delivering his victory speech in the Democratic primary in California. Among Kennedy's campaign workers in Los Angeles that night was a young John Lewis, now a Democratic congressmember from Georgia. Lewis began his political career as one of the youngest people to participate in the freedom rides of the early 1960s, challenging segregation at interstate bus terminals. During these rides, he was beaten severely by mobs. As chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Lewis quickly became a national figure in the civil rights movement. He was one of the main organizers of the 1963 March on Washington, this at the age of 23. A few years later, John Lewis was one of the leaders in a march in Alabama in which Alabama state troopers attacked more than 500 marchers in a confrontation that became known as Bloody Sunday. Decades later, in 1986, John Lewis was elected to Congress after defeating the current NAACP head, Julian Bond, in a tight primary race, and he's now in his sixth term in Congress, where he serves as the chief deputy Democratic whip. He's just written his memoir called Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement, and he joins us now in our studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! And welcome to our new studio.
Well, thank you very much. I am delighted and very pleased to be here, with this great and long-lasting network. You're doing a great job, and I'm glad to be in your studio.
Well, thank you very much. We will soon be in a new studio just across the hall. It's gradually being built, but it really is a historic moment for us. After 20 years of Pacifica Station WBAI being in the Garment District in Midtown Manhattan, we now move to Wall Street. And if the Wall Street brokers don't decide to tune us in on their radios, well, we'll just open the windows and we'll broadcast through megaphones, but they're sure to hear. Well, Congressmember Lewis, why don't we start at the beginning, really where you started, and that's where you were born, on an Alabama farm.
Well, I grew up in Alabama, about 50 miles from Montgomery, near a little place called Troy. My father had been a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. I grew up very, very poor, but I do remember in 1944, when I was 4 years old, my father had saved $300, and with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. And on this land, we raised a lot of cotton and corn and peanuts, hogs and cows and chickens. But at an early age, when I would visit the little town of Troy, or visit the city of Montgomery or Birmingham, I saw those signs that said white men, white women, white waiting, colored waiting. I saw segregation and racial discrimination. And at the age of 15 in 1955, I heard of Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. And that movement under the leadership of Dr. King in Montgomery, organizing the bus boycott, inspired me to find a way to get involved in the civil rights movement.
When did you first hear of Martin Luther King, and how did you hear about him?
When I first heard of Martin Luther King Jr., it was before 1955. It was back in 1954. He was speaking on the radio. He was speaking about freedom, about desegregation. He was saying, in effect, during his sermon, that he was not only concerned about the pearly gates and slippers and crowns and roads some place over yonder, but he was concerned about the streets of Montgomery and the doors of Woolworth. He was concerned about making things better for people in the here and now, right there in Montgomery, back in 1954, a year before the bus boycott of 1955.
Now, at that time, you were studying also to be a preacher. You were hoping to be a preacher.
Well, I was studying to become a minister. I wanted to be a minister. As a matter of fact, on the farm, when I was a very young child, it was my responsibility to raise the chicken, and I fell in love with raising chickens. And some of my first sermons was preaching to the chickens. My younger brothers and sisters and my first cousins would assist in gathering all of the chickens together in the chicken house, and I would talk to these chickens. And as a matter of fact, I would preach to them. And when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their head, some would shake their head. And when I think about it now, they never quite said amen. But I'm convinced that some of these chickens that I preached to in the 40s and in the 50s when I was very young tended to listen to me better than many of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress.
Well, talk about how you first actually met Martin Luther King.
In 1957, when I finished high school, I wanted to attend a little college called Troy State College. It is now known as Troy State University, and it didn't admit black students. I had been accepted at a little school in Nashville, but I wanted to attend Troy State because it was only about 10 miles from my home. So I wrote a letter to Martin Luther King Jr. He wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket. When I was home for spring break in March of 1958, by this time I was 18, my father drove me to the Greyhound bus station on a Saturday morning. I boarded the bus and traveled the 50 miles from Troy to Montgomery. And a young lawyer, never seen a lawyer before, never met one before, a young lawyer by the name of Fred Gray, who was a lawyer for Rosa Parks and Dr. King and the Montgomery Movement, met me at the station and drove me to the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery that was pastored by Reverend Abernathy and ushered me into the office of the church. And there I met Martin Luther King Jr. for the first time. And that was the beginning of a long and beautiful relationship. We became friends, and later we became colleagues in the movement.
He called you the boy from Troy?
He called me the boy from Troy. He said, "Are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis?" I was so nervous, I guess, or scared, meeting this man that I admired from a distance. And I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." I gave my whole name. And he said, "Well, I just wanted to meet the boy from Troy." And so from time to time, he would refer to me as the boy from Troy.
Now, you had a big decision to make then, and that was whether you would be the first African-American to integrate Troy State. And ultimately, you decided not to do that.
I decided to continue to study in Nashville. When it came time to follow suit against the state of Alabama, the State Board of Education, and Troy State, my mother and father were so afraid that we would lose the land or something would happen. And so we dropped the whole idea of my going to Troy State. And I continued to study in Nashville. And I think it worked out because in Nashville, I came in contact with a man by the name of Jim Lawson, who became the teacher of the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. And along with several other students, for the entire school year, a group of us at 6:30 p.m. every Tuesday would go down to a little church and study the philosophy of nonviolence. Study what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he did and accomplished in India.
The Nashville Student Movement, it was called. And I don't know if as many people associate Nashville with the major sit-ins that took place through the South, but it was a major and one of the most organized areas of the South when it came to students and activists organizing.
Well, Nashville emerged as probably the best organized, the best disciplined movement. Martin Luther King Jr. would come to Nashville and say over and over again, he was happy to be in Nashville because it was the best organized and people had a better understanding of the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. And very early on, many of the young people in Nashville accepted nonviolence not simply as a technique or as a tactic, but as a way of life, as a way of living. The first mass arrests in the movement came in February of 1960, and it was in Nashville where almost 100 young people went to jail, and Nashville enabled and encouraged the sit-in movement to spread across the South like wildfire.
Talk about some of those first stores and lunch counters that you integrated just by walking in, and the philosophy of walking in and then walking out.
Well, we will go in to a store and take seats. Black and white students, and we were told that we could not be served. On one occasion, when we were testing a place, the waitress said, "We cannot serve you because you're black, because you're colored, because you're a Negro, and we cannot serve your white friends because they're with you." So they refused to serve an interracial group, and we wanted to make the point, establish the point, that these places were not served. And then we came back and started sitting in on a regular basis. And we were sitting there all day during our homework, reading. And from time to time, someone would come up and pull us off a lunch counter stool, put lighted cigarettes out in our hair, or down our backs, or pour hot coffee or hot chocolate on us. And then from time to time, they would beat us, but we would never strike back. And then we would be arrested and taken off to jail.
But the bus station was a little different because it fell under different laws.
Well, the bus stations all across the South, in many places, were not desegregated until after the Freedom Rides in May of 1961. That had been a United States Supreme Court decision back in the fall of 1960, outlawing segregation in areas of public transportation. But it took the Freedom Rides to make desegregation a reality. I will never forget it as long as I live. A group of us, 13 of us, 7 whites and 6 blacks, went to Washington, D.C. to start the Freedom Ride. We had an orientation from May 1st through May 3rd. And we left on the morning of May 4th, 1961, to travel from Washington through Virginia, through North Carolina, into South Carolina, where the first violence occurred at a little bus station in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where I, along with my seatmate, were attacked trying to enter a so-called white waiting room. And then the bus continued through Georgia and arrived in Alabama, and outside of the city of Anniston, the bus was burned, and people were beaten on the Greyhound bus. And then people were beaten at the Greyhound bus station in Birmingham, the Trailway of bus station. And later, when the Freedom Riders got to Montgomery, they were beaten by the angry mob. And later, we continued into Mississippi, where we were arrested, more than 300 of us that summer, and transferred to the Parchment State Penitentiary.
We're talking to Congressmember John Lewis. That's Georgia Congressmember John Lewis, who was at the heart of the civil rights movement in the early 1960s, talking about the freedom rides that he himself was on. When we come back, we're going to continue this discussion here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Joining me, Congressmember John Lewis, six-term congressmember from Atlanta, Georgia, talking about his history and his new book, Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement. You're talking about the freedom rides, and I thought something interesting that you lay out in the book that, again, these decades later, we forget, or perhaps many, especially young people, don't know about, is the difference in strategy that different groups were advocating. I mean, you had someone like Thurgood Marshall, before he became a U.S. Supreme Court justice, who didn't like the fact that you were getting arrested. He thought that the answer was to challenge the law, but not to go to jail.
We did have people within the movement, within the NAACP League of Defense Fund, or the NAACP, or the Urban League, and some of the other organization, CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, SCLC and Dr. King, and then my old organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And you're so right. Thurgood Marshall thought maybe we can have just one case, a test case, and you fight it through the courts, and you go to the United States Supreme Court. He didn't like the idea that hundreds and thousands of students were getting arrested and going to jail. He said it didn't make sense for us to go to jail. But we wanted to create a mass movement. We wanted to involve more than a few lawyers and one client. We wanted to create a movement where the people would rise up and say, this is what we want, this is what we need, and this is what we're going to get.
Even the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was a bit establishment for all of you, and it seems that you were dragging them along.
But part of the movement was not just a revolt against the system of segregation and racial discrimination in the South, but it was also a revolt against the old guard leadership. We wanted to increase the tempo of change. You know, a slogan was going around during those days, Free by 63. That was the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And people were also saying that we couldn't get a hamburger, we couldn't get a cup of coffee, we couldn't get a soft drink and lunch counters and restaurants in the South, and the whole of Africa would be free, and we were still being segregated in America. So we had to increase the tempo of change.
How significant were the Freedom Rides? I'm looking at a picture in your book, Walking with the Wind, of the Greyhound bus that carried 9 Freedom Riders in Anniston, Alabama, that was firebombed. And you were going to be on that bus, but you had an appointment in Philadelphia.
The Freedom Rides was so significant. It literally took the movement off of college campuses, out of the urban communities, into the small towns, into rural communities. It literally took the movement into the heart of Mississippi, into the heart of Alabama. The Freedom Ride led to the desegregation of all form of public transportation in the South.
How did you go from being a freedom rider to the chair of SNCC, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee?
Well, as a participant in the local movement in Nashville, I have been out there fighting, being there on every demonstration, being willing to put my body on the line. And I think young people all across the South saw me as someone that could inspire others. And I didn't run for the chair or Monsieur Pasnik. I didn't ask to be the chair. And one person by the name of Chuck McDew, who had been the chair, decided to resign. And they elected me. And so I moved from Nashville to Atlanta, where the National Office of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was elected. I was elected chair of SNCC on June 14th, 1963. 7 days later, I was invited to a meeting with President Kennedy and the other black leaders at the White House. And it was during that time that was my first official function. It was at that meeting with President Kennedy that A. Philip Randolph, black labor leader, the dean of black leadership, said to President Kennedy in his baritone voice, he said, "Mr. President, the masses are restless, and we're going to march on Washington." And you can tell by the body language of President Kennedy, he didn't like what he heard. He said, "Mr. Randolph, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be disorder and violence?" And Mr. Randolph responded in discussing what had happened in Birmingham with Bull Connor and the police dogs and the fire hoses. Mr. Randolph said, "Mr. President, this will be an orderly, peaceful, and nonviolent protest." And we started making plans for the March on Washington.
Now, that March on Washington, to say the least, extremely significant. In the latest issue of Emerge magazine, Congressmember Lewis, they excerpt a part of your book where you talk about the speech you were going to give and the speech you gave.
Well, the speech that I had prepared for the March on Washington, I thought represented the feeling, the attitudes, the hopes, the dreams, the longings, the aspiration of the people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but also the indigenous people that we were working with in the heart of the South. You know, President Kennedy took the position that if a person had a sixth grade education, he should be considered literate and should be able to register to vote. In the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, we took the position that the only qualification for being able to register to vote in the South should be that of age and residency. While I was working on my speech, I saw a group of black women carrying signs in what then was Northern Rhodesia, what is now Zambia, saying "one man, one vote." So I said in my March of Washington speech, "One man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too. It must be ours." And then I went on to suggest in the speech that the proposed bill of President Kennedy was too little and was too late, and that there was nothing in this proposed bill to protect women and children involved in peaceful, nonviolent protests, and that we needed something much greater. And I said that the party of Kennedy was a party of Eastland, referring to Senator Eastland, who was chair of the Judiciary Committee of Mississippi, and that the party of Rockefeller was the party of Goldwater. Where is our party?
At the time of the meeting of the Big Six of the Civil Rights Movement, you, John Lewis, Whitney Young, A. Philip Randolph, Dr. Martin Luther King, James Farmer, and Roy Wilkins, Malcolm X said that you'd been co-opted by the president. What's your response to that?
Well, I remember Malcolm being an observer the night before the March on Washington. President Kennedy and his administration was not pleased with the idea of the march, but became very supportive when they saw they couldn't stop it. And I think President Kennedy was very pleased that it was orderly, you didn't have any violence. And in the end, I think he saw the march as a good thing to help educate and sensitize Americans about the problem of race and civil rights. I know the president didn't quote me. I changed some of my speech for the sake of unity and for the sake of solidarity.
Bayard Rustin pushed you to.
Well, Bayard Rustin and some of the church leaders, they thought it was a little too strong. In one part of the speech, I suggested that the day may not come when we would confine our marching on Washington, but we may be forced to march through the South the way Sherman did, nonviolently. And some people didn't like that. And at one point, some people didn't like my use of the word revolution. They didn't like to use the word masses. And A. Philip Randolph came to my rescue, and he said, there's nothing wrong with the use of the word revolution. I said, we are not involved in a serious revolution. We want our freedom, and we want it now. Mr. Randolph says, nothing wrong with the use of the word revolution. There's nothing wrong with the use of the word masses. I use it myself sometimes.
A. Philip Randolph being the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
Well, A. Philip Randolph as an organizer of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, a labor leader, I think he understood this new sense of impatience, this new degree of nonviolent militancy, and he supported it in his own way.
You also talk about what happened with Dr. Martin Luther King at that speech and how he tagged onto his speech or incorporated the I Have a Dream part of his speech.
Well, the I Have a Dream speech, well, it's not something really new for Martin Luther King Jr. I've heard him before in Georgia, in other places, and he had given some parts of that speech at a mass rally in Detroit a few weeks earlier. And there were people in the audience. Mahalia Jackson was saying, for an example, the great gospel singer, saying back in the background, tell him about your dream, Martin. Tell him about your dream. And that day, I think Dr. King really spoke from his heart. He spoke from his soul. And he was sort of lifted up and carried by the crowd when he said, I have a dream that is deeply rooted in the American dream.
Our guest, Congressmember John Lewis, who began his life in a farm, a cotton farm in Alabama, became extremely active in the civil rights movement, chair of SNCC, and went on to be a congressmember from Atlanta, Georgia. You talk in your book, Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement, also about the women leaders. You talk about, and what I liked about, especially about the book, is the mechanisms, is the strategies, is the organizing, that these things don't just happen, that they come from serious thought and activity, like going to the Highlander Center and learning to organize. And you talk about how the Highlander Center in Tennessee was a place that valued women's input as well as men. People like Rosa Parks trained there.
Well, the Highlander Center played a major role in developing many of the talent and thoughtful leaders of vision. They had a wonderful man there by the name of Miles Horton. And not only Miles.
He was the founder.
He was the life and spirit of Highlander. You know, for someone to grow up in the rural South, segregated, Highlander was the first place that I literally had a meal with white individuals. We were all there together, black and white. We were all equal there. We would discuss and debate things, but we would eat together. We would wash dishes together, and it changed my whole life. And then there was a black woman who had been fired as a school teacher in Charleston, South Carolina. She worked on some of the islands around Charleston, named Septa McClark, who was an unbelievable soul. So you had Miles Horton, Septa McClark, and others sort of working there together. And many of the young women that emerged as leaders in SNCC and the movement, in addition to people like Rosa Parks, there was people like Diane Nash, Ruby Doris Smith, and Ella Baker, and others. When I look back on it, women played a major role in the movement. They don't get the credit that they really deserve. But a lot of the necessary work, hard work, tedious day in and day out were the young women in SNCC, in SCLC, in CORE.
And Fannie Lou Hamer had a big
effect. Fannie Lou Hamer, I must never ever forget Fannie Lou Hamer, this indigenous woman who lived and worked on a plantation in the Delta, Mississippi, emerged as one of the real leaders, one of the strong women of the movement.
Boy, there is so much to talk about, and yet we have very little time. And so I wanted to move forward, Congressmember Lewis, to why you decided then to get involved with electoral politics. I mean, this is the weekend where we remember Robert Kennedy, the 30th anniversary of his assassination in 1968. And you decided to support his candidacy for president in 1968.
I was deeply inspired by what I saw happening in the movement itself. Without Martin Luther King Jr., I don't know where I would be. I could still be down there in rural Alabama, probably preaching to those chickens. But I tell you, Dr. King had the ability, he had the capacity to inspire people to stand up. And then I came in contact with Robert Kennedy, and I was so convinced that he could get elected, win the Democratic nomination, end the war in Vietnam, and maybe move us closer, much closer toward a truly interracial democracy of what Dr. King called the beloved community. I saw Robert Kennedy grow. I'm talking about this young man grew overnight, the same way some of us grew up by sitting in at lunch counters or standing in at theaters or going on a freedom ride. He grew up. On one occasion, he told me, in the mid-60s, he said, "I now understand the young people, the students, have educated me." And today I see my involvement in politics as an extension of my involvement in the civil rights movement.
It was you who, in 1968, the night that Martin Luther King was killed, April 4th, just 2 months before Robert Kennedy was killed, who told Robert Kennedy you thought he should address a crowd. Was it in Indianapolis?
We were in Indianapolis preparing for a rally, and there was some concern about whether Robert Kennedy should speak to this crowd. And I insisted that Robert Kennedy had to speak. The great majority of the people there didn't know that Dr. King had been shot. I had only heard that he had been shot. We didn't know his condition. But it was Robert Kennedy who made the decision to come and speak and announce to the crowd and to all of us that Dr. King had been assassinated. And after Dr. King was assassinated and after his funeral, I sort of said to myself, I'm not going to become lost in a sea of despair. And I threw myself into the Kennedy campaign. And I went to Oregon and went on to California and asked that we still have Robert Kennedy.
It was in California, within those last few days of Robert Kennedy's life, that J. Edgar Hoover, wanting to get Kennedy, released some extremely damaging information, especially in the eyes of the black community. And that was Robert Kennedy, when he was attorney general, had bugged Martin Luther King. What was your response in California at that time?
During that time, I was in California campaigning for Robert Kennedy. And I saw this as a deliberate, dirty trick on the part of J. Edgar Hoover and maybe some other people in the administration.
Although it was true.
It was true. But it was J. Edgar Hoover who was obsessed with the thought that Dr. King was being used by the Communist Party. It was J. Edgar Hoover who was obsessed with the idea that the students, that we needed someone in Moscow or someone in New York or someone in Washington to tell us that segregation was wrong, to sit in or go on a freedom ride. And Robert Kennedy responded. And if he could speak to us today, I think he would say what he did was wrong. It was a mistake. He should have stood up to J. Edgar Hoover and never granted that request.
He ultimately said to justify what he did, that he bugged him to prove to J. Edgar Hoover that it wasn't true.
And I believed him. I believed him. I think if Dr. King had lived and if Robert Kennedy had lived, I think Dr. King would have voted for Robert Kennedy and supported him. Maybe not got out and campaigned for him in a partisan way, but would have voted for him. Because I think Dr. King saw the potential, saw the possibility with this young political leader. I think something happened in America, something died in all of us with the death of these two young men.
And maybe someday Robert Kennedy would have voted for Martin Luther King.
That is possible if Dr. King had got involved in electoral politics.
Congressmember Lewis, we have to break again, and then we'll just have a few minutes, but I want to ask you then about your own race for Congress and what you're focusing on now. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest, Congressmember John Lewis of Georgia. He's written an autobiography called Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement. Stay with us.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, our guest, Congressmember John Lewis of Georgia. He has a new book, Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement. In 1986, Congressmember, you won from your district in Atlanta, and you beat out a friend, Julian Bond.
Julian Bond is a friend. Julian is a good friend. We have worked together in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee for several years. We worked together when I was head of the Voter Education Project. We both sought the same position. It was an open seat. And everybody thought he was going to win. I came from far, far behind. I worked very, very hard. And I created a biracial coalition in that district and brought people together. It was the hardest thing I ever done in my life. It was a great victory. And I'm running now again for my seventh term.
And your neighbor is Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House.
The Speaker of the House is my neighbor. He's a very strange and complex individual. I think he's out of step and he's out of tune with the hope and optimism that existed in another period, in another time. And sometimes I think he wants to take us back to another period, to another time. And we have to continue to say to the Speaker, my neighbor, that we will not go back. We will not stand still. We will continue to move toward the building of a just and open society, for none of our citizens are left behind.
Let me ask you about some of the issues you're taking up now and also some of your other neighbors. For example, you're serving now with old-time segregationists, people like Strom Thurmond. How does it feel to be walking through the same halls?
I think the book and what I'm doing now tell us something about the distance we have come and the distance we still must go before we complete the laying down of the burden of race in America. If someone had told me just a few short years ago that I would be in the Congress, in the same Congress, with Strom Thurmond, I would say, you're crazy. You're out of your mind. You don't know what you're talking about. I give you another example. The gentleman who met the Greyhound bus at the Alabama line when we were going into Mississippi, was the general of the Mississippi National Guard, a man by the name of Sonny Montgomery. When I got to Congress, he was there as chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee. Even some of the people who were on the other side are saying now that they were wrong. So this is something about a new America, a better America. We're not completely home yet. We have not yet created the beloved community because the scars and stains of racism are still deeply embedded in American society. So we still must make progress. And I hope this book and I hope my life story, which is not just my story, but it's the story of so many people, would inspire our young people and those of us not so young to find a way to get involved.
One of the latest issues that the Congressional Black Caucus has taken up is the issue of driving while black. And I think this is very interesting when you go back to the Freedom Rides. But that idea that Maryland state troopers, that New Jersey state troopers, that police around the country are pulling over young, particularly black men, and arresting them and harassing them. What is the Congressional Black Caucus doing about this?
Well, the Congressional Black Caucus has introduced a resolution, a sort of a sense of the Congress resolution. Hopefully it will come up and be debated to try to send a message, try to sensitize police officers and law enforcement people all around the country about what is happening. It is very difficult to grow up young in America, but it's much more difficult to grow up young and black and male, especially in certain parts of America today. Racism is still there, and we have to find a way to say to people, let's come together, deal with it. Don't sweep it under the rug. Don't try to hide it. Let's deal with it. Let's face it head on. And that's what I've been trying to do as a member of Congress, engage in meaningful dialogue on the whole question of race with colleagues of mine, Republican member, conservative member, Democratic members, liberals as well as conservative and moderate members.
And when you say engage, do you mean in a formal way?
Well, we have conducted workshops and meetings in different parts of the country, in parts of Georgia and parts of Michigan, where we tried to bring people together, black and white. I was in the state of Michigan just about a week ago. And there's two towns. One is St. Joe, and the other one is Bent Harbor. And the St. Joe's River, separate the two towns. One town is predominantly black, one is predominantly white. And we brought the mayors together, we brought the police chiefs together, and the Rotary clubs together, the religious leaders together. We had a whole day discussing race, and I visit both towns with the local congressperson who's a Republican. We got to do more of this. We got to talk to each other. During the 60s, we had a coalition of conscience. We engaged in dialogue. And we created what we call in SNCC a circle of trust, a band of brothers and sisters. In the 90s, we talk about race, but we don't talk to each other. Blacks talk to blacks about race. Whites talk to whites about race. But we need to create that sense of dialogue, and then we should act to do something about it.
Well, Congressmember John Lewis, I want to thank you very much for stopping by and also helping to inaugurate our new studios, our first live guest at Democracy Now! On Wall Street. John Lewis, a six-term congressmember, hoping to be a seventh-term congressmember from Atlanta, Georgia, and he's written his autobiography. It's called Walking with the Wind, A Memoir of the Movement. I hope this is just part one.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
The book is published by Simon & Schuster. We'll be back in a second.
Oh, he don't know.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting for the first time from our new home on Wall Street. That's right, we have moved to Wall Street with Pacifica Station WBAI, and so the voice of the people is now broadcasting from the belly of the beast. We'll be the fly on the wall, sometimes off the wall, certainly up against the wall. And we follow in a proud tradition of progressive journalism that's also in this area's heritage, from the first African-American newspaper in the country, founded in 1928, to the American newspaper that employed the original Marxist, Karl Marx, as its foreign correspondent. Here now to give our listeners a tour of our new digs and their surroundings is Bruce Caton. For 8 years now, Bruce has been guiding people on historic adventures through Manhattan neighborhoods on radical walking tours. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!, Bruce.
Yes, good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me. I always knew you'd make it to Wall Street. I just had that feeling. But there's a lot of great radical history here. People say Wall Street, that's where all the rich are. That's where all the stocks are. But there have been so many protests here over the years against the rich. Now, WBAI is located right near the New York Stock Exchange. The current building, a big, august, imperial-looking building, went up in 1903. But in 1966, during the Vietnam War, students against war and fascism released hundreds of leaflets onto the floor condemning the massive profits that were being made by the Pentagon and by the corporate companies traded on the New York Stock Exchange. The next year, Abbie Hoffman, in a pre-Yippie action, 1967, released hundreds of dollar bills on the floor of the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange and proclaimed the death of money. Candace Bergen, before she was Murphy Brown, was also there. They did a little dance in front, got a lot of publicity, and started Abbie Hoffman on his way to hundreds of demonstrations here in New York City.
But that was a very funny demonstration because, of course, the stockbrokers all dove for the money.
That's right. They went for those dollar bills. And ever since then, the New York Stock Exchange has put up a glass panel so you can't throw any type of leaflets, any type of alternative information into the New York Stock Exchange. But hopefully they get WBAI and the Pacifica Foundation in there.
Now, right here where we are now located, which is right at the end of Wall Street, overlooking the East River. And I might add for our listeners, at this moment, President Clinton is landing on the helicopter pad right next to us. We can see him out the window because that's where he flies in when he's coming to New York. But right here is also the African burial ground.
Well, actually, the Royal African Trading Company used to set up right here at Wall Street. We used to be actually in the water where we're standing right now. And the Royal African Trading Company set up in 1711 for the millions of African slaves who were traded. You could also rent slaves at that point, too. Symbolic, right at the foot of Wall Street. The British, who took over, New York, named it New Amsterdam in 1664, by the 1700s had millions of slaves going through New York's ports. This was the number two port for slaves in the United States after South Carolina. Now, there's also lots of other history as well. The FALN, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement group, they ended up bombing a symbol, Francis Tavern, of the American Revolution after many Puerto Ricans were killed and injured in bombings against the Puerto Rican Independent Movement back in Puerto Rico. And they threatened, finally, we're going to do one bombing back if you don't stop the violence. They did that. It stopped the violence at Francis Tavern in January 1975. There's also, as you walk through Wall Street, there's tons of gigantic buildings on very narrow lanes. They follow the layout of the early Dutch days. The early streets follow early Native American burial sites, early Native American paths as well. They were widened by the slaves who built all the initial infrastructure here in New York City, and some of them follow the same patterns from 200 to 300 years ago and hundreds of years before that with Native Americans. One of the other big bombings here in the Wall Street area was the bombing of J.P. Morgan and Company at Broad and Wall Street. The dynamite marks from that 1920 blast are still visible. They've been left there kind of as a lesson to us radicals to behave ourselves. But it was done in 1920 by an Italian anarchist to avenge the arrest of Sacco and Vanzetti and also the torture, the harassment, and the arrest of many other anarchists, labor organizers, and immigrants as well who were organizing at that time. And Sacco and Vanzetti were the famous Italian anarchists executed in 1927 after a horrible trial where the judge called them, we have to execute those horrible anarchists. He said that in the elevator chamber outside of the court. They had a horrible trial. It was one of the worst cases of the 20th century, along with the Rosenberg case as well.
And how did they ultimately find the man who bombed J.P. Morgan's building?
Paul Avrich, the famous anarchist historian, wrote a book, Sacco Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, and it gives you all the history on that. Now, the police went to 5,000 stables looking for the – they had the horseshoe. They didn't have the horse anymore after the explosion, but they had the horseshoe. They went to 5,000 stables. They traced it to a stable on Elizabeth Street where a horse and carriage were rented. The U.S. government never found who did it. Paul Avrich, interviewing people, going back into the Italian anarchist movement, said it was Mario Buda, who was promptly went back to Italy, fought against Mussolini, was arrested in Italy, and died many years later as well.
Many symbols of international capitalism here. J.P. Morgan, also Rockefeller.
That's right. The Rockefellers, there was a famous protest in the 1910s down at 26 Broadway, the old Standard Oil headquarters. They were the big monopolists of the late 19th, early 20th century, the Bill Gates of that era, the Microsoft of that era. And they had the oligopoly, near monopoly, on oil production in the United States. And there was a major protest when workers in Colorado at the Colorado Fuel and Mine Iron Company went on strike. They wanted to unionize. The Rockefeller-owned company said, no, you cannot unionize. And there was a horrible attack on the workers who were living in a tent colony in April of 1914 in Ludlow, Colorado, which became known as the famous Ludlow Massacre. 13 women and children were killed after a horrible fire. Oil was poured on the tents they were living in. It was set on fire. Eventually, 33 people would be killed, close to 40 actually, over a nine-month strike. And to protest that, there was a protest at Standard Oil's headquarters because Rockefeller also owned the mine company. Upton Sinclair, the great novelist who wrote The Jungle, he was there. And Maria Gans, who was a famous Jewish Lower East Side Yiddish-speaking activist, marched right into Rockefeller's office and said, Mr. Rockefeller, if you kill one more worker, I will hunt you down like a dog. Of course, she was arrested, but many other protests ever since. And eventually in 1911, the Standard Oil Trust was broken up into smaller pieces, similar to what was done to the telephone company not too long ago.
Would you say Wall Street is the most recognized name of a street in the world?
Yes, definitely. And we should also remember, too, the Wall Street represents the original wall that was set up by the Dutch that was built by enslaved Africans to keep the Native Americans out. As the Dutch were encroaching on more and more land, killing more and more Native Americans, many of the massacres of Native Americans in the 17th century originated near here as well. Eventually, the fence was taken down and it was used as firewood by the British, but its name remains the same, and the outlook, the layout of Wall Street follows that exact original wall from the past as well. So very historic down here, and it is good BAI is down here as well. There's a lot of good alternative information.
Well, if people come, listeners perhaps to Democracy Now! And other parts of the country come to New York, I have to highly recommend Bruce Caton's tours of New York. And Bruce, if people want to get in touch with you and the Radical Walking Tours, where can they call?
They can call me at 718-492-0069. I have 14 different radical history tours of Manhattan. I give two a month. I go February through December, and that's 718-492-0069. I met a lot of WBAI listeners Saturday, came out on my Lower East Side tour, and hope to see more again.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us a tour of our new digs and their surroundings, Bruce Caton. And folks, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Jeremy Scahill. Our engineer today is Paul Ruest. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. Our webmaster is Michelle Garcia. If you'd like our website, you can go to www.pacifica.org. We're also broadcasting on the Internet. And you can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And thanks to Bernard White for our music today. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifico Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.